We've come to the yellow rite, the rite of prospering today. So some people have been asking about these rites and what they mean. So I just thought I'd sort of make it clear. So in ancient India, as in many places around the world, there were and are rites, magical rites that involve the use of colour and, well, spells or mantra to cultivate certain things, in this case, to cultivate wealth. So, you know, in those days, as indeed in the present in India, perhaps you're poor or you're concerned that your crops will ripen at the right time, you'd pay someone to undertake these magical rites for you. And they would do some rituals and some chanting, and then hopefully that would make a difference. There's a bit of a problem about this in the rite of wealth, because you do have to pay for it. It doesn't come for free, the magical rites. But anyway, you decide to invest the money in that way. So what the Vajrayana did, as indeed early Buddhism as well, was it really saw that actually colour and sound have an effect. They do have an effect on the mind, a transformative effect on the mind. If you're surrounded by the colour, for example, yellow, it has a certain impact on your consciousness. This beautiful sunny day is having an impact on your consciousness. Mantra has an impact on your consciousness. The things we say to each other has an impact on your consciousness. So it decided to use those things in order to develop certain qualities and states of mind. So we know this as Buddhas and Bodhisattva figures, which are different colours, and mantra. So I remember there's I think it's a seminar, and someone asked the front, they say, well, what's the effect of doing the green Tara practice? And he said, well, the effect of doing the green Tara practice is that I am in increasing relationship with the spiritual quality of the colour green. So there we go, that was all he said. So there is a spiritual quality to colours, and they have a particular effect on the mind, particularly very pure colours. So what the Triratna Buddhist community did, well, Subhuti in particular, but he established a tradition of talking about friendship in terms of the rites, not because there's a magical spell or a particular ritual that we do around friendship and the rites, but because the rites have particular moods that we're cultivating in friendship. Do you see what I mean? So it's a mood rather than an actual ritual that we've developed. So the mood of spiritual friendship that we're exploring today is the yellow mood, which is the rite of, or associated with the rite of prospering, or sometimes maturation. So it's the yellow rite, the yellow of the sun on a clear summer's day, very much like today. It's the yellow of light reflecting from gold, pure gold, a gold necklace or a gold ring. It's the yellow of ripening grains in the autumn and the sunlight on ripening grains. It's the yellow of the light reflected from yellow flowers like buttercups. I was very pleased to see that, I've talked about Claudia, haven't I? My friend Claudia, she's got a daughter and a son, and we were walking through a field of buttercups together, and she picked up the buttercups like she did when we were five, and she put it underneath her daughter's chin, and she said, do you like butter? Does anyone else do that? It's a little thing, yeah. You know, you put it underneath your chin. You say, do you like butter? And of course it reflects, everyone likes butter. Veganism doesn't come into it in this particular... That's the sort of English magical rite. It's not really about butter. So yes, it's that. It's that. Such a joyful thing to do. Such a joyful thing to do, to put a buttercup underneath someone's chin. I think we should all do it. I'm going to find a buttercup. And it gives a certain quality, a certain joy. So this is the rite of enriching. Originally, it was about cultivating wealth, but also it became about, in the Buddhist tradition, it became about cultivating spiritual qualities. Actually, incidentally, in the early Buddhist tradition, what they would do is they would get a coloured disc in front of them and look at the coloured disc for a long time and then visualise it in their minds. So they would get natural objects. So, for example, well, I don't think ancient India had buttercups, but we would get buttercups or dandelions and put them in a coloured disc on the ground and visualise them. Which has an effect, actually. Someone did it at a retreat at Tirunelloka. They made all these coloured discs with natural objects on the ground. And if you sat there and just looked at it for a long time and then closed your eyes and internalised the qualities of that colour, it really did have an effect. So, yes, the yellow rite becomes associated with the rite of accumulating sort of spiritual qualities as well as wealth. Because I say as well as, because we all need some wealth, particularly if we're going to spread the Buddha's teaching. Dr. Ambedkar said that to renounce riches voluntarily is a noble thing, but living in poverty is a living hell. And he said that he wouldn't follow any religion that ennobled poverty for its own sake. So the Buddha had quite a pragmatic relationship with wealth. He didn't see it as dirty or tainted. In fact, he compared it to having a clear pool. So there was a story that a very rich miser died, and because he hadn't got any relations or anyone that he'd passed his wealth on to, it came to the king. So the king Pasenadi and the Buddha had quite a good relationship, and they'd often sort of, they were both about the same age, I think, and they'd sit there and talk about things like old age. I really like this sort of the king and the Buddha talking about old age. And the spiritual qualities of the Sangha and all sorts of things. And one day King Pasenadi said, "Oh yes, I've just come from distributing this rich man's wealth because he died without anyone, without any friends or without any relations." And the Buddha said, "Oh yes." He said, "Well, that's like, if you've got wealth, it's like having a beautiful pool in a forest." He said, "If you don't use it, it becomes clogged with weeds and overgrown and stagnant. And eventually, and you know this, eventually it might even close up. But," he said, "if you have wealth and you share it with others and you use it well, it's like having a beautiful pool in the forest that everyone can delight in. And on a hot day, everyone can bathe in the pool and drink from the pool and enjoy the riches that the pool provides." So it's a very different idea of wealth than thinking of it as dirty or mucky. So yes, so we do need some wealth sometimes as well. So when Bhante was talking about setting up a Buddhist movement, maybe even before, but his teacher Yogi Chen said to him, "Oh, well, if you're going to set up a Buddhist movement, you're going to need some money." So he gave him a particular visualization, the Jambala practice, which is the Bodhisattva of wealth, who Jambala is sort of a very yellow, portly sort of Bodhisattva, and he squeezes a mongoose. Does he squeeze it? Sometimes I have to check this out. Yeah, and it comes out of his mouth, doesn't it? Yeah. Good, I didn't make that up. Sometimes I'm not sure what my imagination does. So yes, so he did that practice. But it's also more than that, because of course the Buddha said the true wealth is faith. True wealth is Shraddha or Saddha. Because all positive qualities have faith in their as their basis. And it's not a kind of literal faith in the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha. It's more like, what Bhante talks about faith, he says it's what's ultimate in us resonates with what's ultimate in the universe. So it's a sense of a desire to cultivate skillful states of mind, a desire to cultivate skillful, positive qualities and to see into the nature of reality and to see that as possible. So, yes, yeah, so the yellow rite becomes the rite of abundant and increase, of enrichment, but really about enriching in terms of spiritual qualities, but also in terms of culture and beauty. Because all those things, spiritual qualities, culture and beauty, are all related. So I was very pleased that we did that exercise yesterday, and someone made the comment that when you reflect on an experience of beauty, it has the same qualities as spiritual friendship, spiritual experiences, and relationship to the Buddha. So all these things cultivate the same state of mind. So in early Buddhism, as in later Buddhism, there's a very important practice which we did this morning of dwelling on the beauty of the Buddha, which also brings us into the spiritual qualities of the Buddha. It helps us, dwelling on the beauty of the Buddha and the beauty of the Buddha's form, leads us on into a kind of desire for enlightenment. There's a lovely story about this in an early Mahayana sutra called the Rashtrapala Paripritcha. I just wanted to say it. I can't spell it. Don't ask me to put it on a flip chart. The Rashtrapala Paripritcha Sutra. So anyway, it's got this, it's a sort of story within the story. And the story goes that there was this prince, a bit like the Buddha, a young prince, who had everything he wanted but was sort of dissatisfied. And it said that at night the devas would come, the devas and devis, the gods and goddesses would come and start whispering and singing outside his room, telling of the beauty of the spiritual life. That if you cultivate skillful qualities, then people expand and relax, the generosity invites generosity, that there's a way of being in the world which cultivates positivity and joy. And they say, well, you know, people do that. They cultivate spiritual qualities, and all sorts of wonderful things happen when you cultivate spiritual qualities. So he starts to become interested in a kind of higher way of life that's about more than just pleasure and conquering, which is what his life would have been about. And then they start coming in and they start saying, but there's also something called the Buddha. And then they start rejoicing in the, it's very interesting, sort of long rejoicing, and one must, I imagine that they sang it, I don't think that they said it, or they said it in a kind of chanting, lilting verse about the beauty of the Buddha, about how his neck reached out like a swan, and how his teeth were like conch shells, and his eyes like blue lotuses, and his skin was the colour of gold, and he walked like a lion, like an elephant, like the king among men. And they go into all these beautiful verses about the Buddha. And what you get the sense of is that in the young prince, he starts to, it starts to change his state of consciousness until he decides to renounce the palace and leave home. Actually, what he does at that point, which you shouldn't repeat, you know, because it's metaphorical, is that he jumps off the roof of the palace, and the Buddha catches him in an enormous white lotus. So please don't do that. The Buddha may or may not catch you in an enormous white lotus. I think what he's trying to say is that he goes into a state of consciousness that's beyond. So yes, yeah, so if you dwell on beauty, if you dwell on culture and the arts and enrichment, if you dwell on the richness of spiritual qualities, there's an atmosphere of ripening, and that's what we're doing in spiritual friendship. We're cultivating an atmosphere of enrichment and ripening. So I said the other day that the Buddha would, in the morning, he would wake up and he would search around with his Buddha eye to see who was ripe for the Dharma. So there's a story about that, which was that there was a leper who, someone who was suffering from leprosy, who lived from begging, and he saw a great crowd developing. So he went up to the crowd thinking that he could get some food. He thought, oh, great, you know, there's a big crowd, so I'll be able to get some alms food today. But the Buddha had scanned around with the eye of the Buddha, and he'd clocked the person suffering from leprosy and thought, that person is ripe for the Dharma. And then he did what's quite traditional in the Buddhist tradition. He talks about the beauty and rewards of renunciation, which is interesting. You don't think of renunciation having being particularly beautiful or having rewards. But of course, they're rewards of a particular kind. I always think it's interesting that the greatest poetry in the Buddhist tradition, the most beautiful poetry, is written by the greatest renunciants. Because, of course, when you're not occupied with that kind of gaining of wealth in its limited sense for yourself, you're alive to the beauty around you, which is like retreat, really, because we're not worried about, you know, you cease to worry about what you're wearing, kind of. This is hot or cold, but, you know, you cease to worry about what you look like. You cease to worry about getting money and status and all those things. You quiet your mind, quieten your mind. You live a simple life. And in the simplicity of your life, beauty is apparent to you in everything, which you might have experienced. So the Buddha talks about the beauty and the rewards of renunciation. And then it says, when the Blessed One, the Bhagavan, knew that Supa Buddha, the leper's mind, was ready, malleable, free from hindrances, elevated and clear, then he gave the Dharma talk unique to the awakened ones. So that atmosphere of enriching cultivates a mind that is ready, malleable, free from hindrances, elevated and clear. And that mind is receptive to the Dharma. So it said that the mind, his mind was like a clean cloth, free from stains. And just as a clean cloth, free from stains, properly absorbs a dye, in the same way as Supa Buddha, the leper, was sitting in that very seat, the dustless, stainless Dharma eye arose in him. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. So yes, the clean cloth takes the dye. The elevated, clear mind in touch with beauty receives the Dharma, sees into the Dharma. So it's very important that we cultivate enjoyment in the spiritual life. And to not be afraid of cultivating enjoyment in the spiritual life. There's an association with the spiritual life as being grim and sort of hunkered down and a bit, you know, suffering. But actually, the nature of the spiritual life is in, as conceived in the Dharma, is of unfolding positive mental states, joy upon joy. Joy, rapture, calm, bliss, meditation, seeing into reality. Wonderful. Such richness. So the Buddha distinguished between the pleasures of the wheel of life, the pleasures of samsara, and the pleasures of the spiral path. He distinguished between what's called samisar pleasures, so that's pleasures of the wheel of life, which literally translates as fleshy. So fleshy pleasures, and unfleshy pleasures, which is about the pleasures of the path. And the difference is that with the pleasures of the wheel, they're never quite enough. We always want a bit more because they don't truly satisfy us. So that's why it's a wheel of life. It's a bit like those hamsters on a wheel, which is probably a really cruel thing to do, just thinking about it. But, you know, they run on this little wheel because they're always trying to get somewhere, but they're never getting anywhere. Because it's pleasure that's not really satisfying. Because you're grasping onto an experience that you want to have and define yourself by. So So that's the pleasures of the Wheel of Life, is wanting to have, to define yourself, to keep and to hold a particular experience. Whereas pleasures of the path are delighting in something for its own sake without having to have it or own it or let it define you. So the Buddha, when he was leaving behind a life of extreme asceticism and wondering how to gain enlightenment, he had that memory. He had a memory of sitting underneath the rose apple tree with his father. Sometimes they say in a kind of ploughing competition. And he remembered that at that time he sat under the rose apple tree and he entered into a state of higher consciousness. And he remembered that, which is interesting because he'd only got into the first dhyana at that point, whereas later on with his other Buddhist teachers, he got into the four formless dhyanas. So why would he remember that incident rather than the higher states of consciousness he'd got into with his teachers? Well, Bhante gives a very interesting exposition of this in the Three Jewels, where he says the difference is that when he was with his teachers, he was forcing himself to get into the higher states of concentration, the formless dhyanas, by a state of will. He was forcing himself by a state of will. Whereas when he was a child sitting under the rose apple tree, that state of mind came to him naturally and with joy and pleasure. So at that point, when the Buddha remembers that incident of the rose apple tree, he says, "Why should I be afraid of pleasure?" Which is not associated with grasping. Why should I be afraid of pleasure, which is not associated with grasping? And because it arose naturally in a state of beauty, in a beautiful context, interestingly, under a tree, which is where the great events of the Buddhist life happened. So sometimes I think we need to remember that, particularly even in meditation. We were talking yesterday about experiencing pleasure in meditation. Do not be afraid of pleasure, in the spiritual life. And one of the pleasures and delights of the spiritual life is friendship. We might remember from the Anuruddhas, they said about each other, "It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life." And one can really feel that sometimes. One can really look around and see one's friends and think, "Oh, my life is so blessed. Look at these people. They're such good people. They're such wonderful people. They're so open and, they really care. And even when they get things wrong, they want to put it right. You know, they want to communicate." And one can have that sense of being around one's friends. It's a very beautiful sense, taking delight in the beauty of one's friends. In the Vimalakirti Nadesha, Vimalakirti said, he compares, this is a teaching to Mara's daughters actually, which is another thing in itself, but he wasn't saying to Mara's daughters, "Get thee hence, you," I would kind of think of a word that's not rude, but you hussies, yeah. No, thank you. "Get thee hence, you hussies." he says, "Do you really want to know how to live in the pleasure garden of the Dharma?" Which is a very sensual image, actually, the pleasure garden of the Dharma to Mara's daughters. And they all say, "Yes, we want to know how to live in the pleasure garden of the Dharma." He says, "This is how you do it." And he talks about the joy of practicing the perfections. And one of my favourite things is he says, "It's such a joy to be an ornament on the seat of enlightenment." I thought, yeah, wouldn't that be brilliant? What a joy. And he says it's a joy to give to your friends. It's a joy to be in relationship with friendship. He talks quite a bit about friendship. It's a joy not to feel conceit. It's a joy not to feel below people. It's a joy to just be with your spiritual friends and to reverence your spiritual teachers. So yes, there's this very beautiful image. And he says it's in that garden that beings are ripened. So the Vimalakirti Nadesha talks a lot about how to ripen beings, which again is a very beautiful image of beings coming into fruition. Just like when the Buddha gained enlightenment and he looked with his Buddha eye, he saw all beings like lotuses emerging from the mud of existence and opening out into the light, ripening in the sunshine. Actually, well, the last time I saw Sangharakshita, he said to me, he said, yes, one must be careful that one doesn't simply look after one's own garden. You know? So there's also an image that if one has a garden, like the pool in the forest, that one shares the garden. Because how does that garden grow? How do you ripen beings in that garden? You ripen beings by dana, by giving, by generosity. So this is the Sangraha Vastu that's very much associated. I like the way I say that. Very much associated with the rite of prospering. I did make that up, the link, just to be honest about it. But I think it goes with the rite of prospering. How could it not? Dana, giving. And Bhante talks about dana and giving. He says, giving to your friends is an expression of your special awareness of them. Which I think is a very thing, something worth reflecting on. To give to your friends is an awareness of them, because of course we don't just give them anything. We think about that person. We hold them in mind. We think, oh, you know, this person would like this. I was just thinking about Ruth actually, when Ruth asked for ordination and we gave her a present and some schminkly bits, and I thought, well, what would Ruth like at this moment? And it was definitely lip balm. Because in the setup, for some reason, all of our lips were like really chapped. So yes, so that's bearing someone in mind, thinking, what do they actually need or want? We have a special awareness of them. We have to reflect on them. And it's the nature of positive emotion towards our friend that wants to be expressed. And it's expressed in dana. Love wants to give. So what do you give? Will you give primarily of yourself? You give your positive qualities. Again, in the Vimalakirti Nadesha, he talks about, and again, to Mara's daughter, he says, they say to him, but now we're living in the pleasure garden of the Dharma. How are we going to live in the realm of Mara? Because he sends them back home. He doesn't keep them. He sends them back home to Mara. And he says, well, in the abode of Mara, you have to practice the teaching of the inexhaustible lump. What is the teaching of the inexhaustible lump? He says, well, if you teach and demonstrate skillful qualities to others, they grow in those spiritual qualities, and so do you. He said, it's like a light. You can light many other lights off a single lamp without that lamp being diminished. And so it is with skillful qualities. The more you demonstrate and share your spiritual qualities, you grow in this respect to those spiritual qualities. You don't diminish. There's not just like a certain quota of skillful qualities that you have to sort of, you know, generosity only so far because I've got a pot of generosity. Generosity invites generosity. So if you share your inspiration and the joy of practicing the spiritual life, if we do that together, we uplift each other. And I think culture can really come into that. Some of my sort of most beautiful moments with my friends have been also in a context of beauty and higher culture. So I was thinking of a day Kusala Devi and I spent just before this retreat. So I was in, well, we were both in Cornwall, but in separate places, and I was feeling a little bit miserable. And Kusala Devi, being a Devi, came of skillfulness and virtuous qualities. it's being recorded, by the way. Anyway, so... She came and rescued me, and we went to the Tate in St Ives and to the Barbara Hepworth Sculpture Garden, and it was a beautiful day. It was like this. It was completely clear blue sky, and St Ives is very beautiful. It's got these beautiful golden sandy beaches, and we were going around these art galleries, and we went into the sculpture garden of Barbara Hepworth, and honestly, it was like going to a Devaloka. It had all these amazing sculptures, and I love Barbara Hepworth. And then there was this cherry tree that was the blossomiest blossom ever. It was completely at its full glory of blossomness, bright pink and fluttering everywhere in the sky, in this blue sky. And, you know, and as we know, Kusala Devi herself is also very beautiful. So it was overwhelming. really quite overwhelming. Such joy to be in that situation. And of course, what happened to my mind is it lifted. And I noticed it really fed into my meditation. We both bought the Barbara Hepworth Writings and Sayings book because I was thinking, this is meditation. This is how we have to access the dhyanas, you know, how to inspire my meditation practice. It's just it's a creative work of art. So, yeah, so it's that kind of thing that we can do to each other. Share what you love, what brings you alive, even if your friend doesn't have quite the same taste as you. Sometimes that happens. I really love hearing about what brings people alive, even if it isn't really, you know, I've never thought of it before. I suddenly develop these enthusiasms. And we've got to listen to each other's sort of tender shoots of love for beauty without judgment and without dismissing and trampling them or just listen and allowing that to come out in each other, encouraging each other. I've learned so much through my friends about all sorts of things, you know, and being introduced to wonderful composers or singers or films or books that have really made my life richer. Because, of course, we carry our friends with us. You know, we don't learn things on our own. We learn things through the inspiration of others. And sometimes people have shared, for example, a piece of music that's really inspired them. And then that becomes kind of part of me as well. I remember we had this lovely evening to people in Sheffield, when I lived in Sheffield, and Kirsty and Claire, they came round to my flat. My flat was like 414 of a high rise in a council estate, and all sorts of bonkers things happened in that, you know, really strange things in that block of flats. But in this little flat, we had my stereo, and we were listening to. We decided to share our favourite pieces of classical music. That was right, because Kirsty didn't know. She said, "I don't really know anything about classical music." So Claire and I decided to come up with a list, and we all listened to each other. And in the end, we were all dancing around the flat, pretending to be conductors. Anyway, it was really good. And we stayed there really late as well, because we just wanted to keep going. It was so joyful. So we share each other's enthusiasm and love of beauty, but we also share friendship. You know, we delight in the mandala of friendship. In the Gandavyuha Sutra, the whole story is about Sudana, this young man who goes from Kalyana Mitra to Kalyana Mitra, asking about how to practice as a bodhisattva, how to undertake the path of the bodhisattva. And each teacher tells him what they know, how they practice and the things that they've seen. And they say, but how could I exhaust the virtues of the spiritual life? How could I exhaust the virtues of the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva practices? I couldn't possibly tell you anything. You must go and see this next person. And they pass him on, so sort of person to person to person, including night goddesses and children and monks and nuns and princes and princesses and kings and queens and all these people, just saying, well, go to this person next, go to this person next. And what you're left with is this great kind of mandala of friendship and all the things that he takes from that relationship and all the things that he learns, which is really, you know, the rite of enriching. So, yes, yeah, so it's moving away from possessiveness in friendship to giving. Oh. I know, it's hard. No, that is the next sentence in my talk. It says it's not easy. It's not easy because we do experience envy and jealousy in friendship. You know, that also happens. And, you know, how does one feel when you've got your friend and then you see them having a great time with someone else? You know, sometimes a bit painful. So sometimes you have to practice as an aspirational rite as well. Well, I aspire to be more generous with my friends in that way. I think if you really struggle with jealousy and envy, one of the things you can do is when you go home is to just fill your shrine with yellow. And it helps, because the colour yellow makes you feel richer, it helps move from this kind of poverty mentality of there's only so many qualities or only so much friendship to go around, into this state, which is that nothing is mine to have or to hold, which means everything is mine to have and to hold, conversely, which is the consort of Ratnasambhava, who's the Buddha associated with this yellow rite. His consort is Mamaki, mind maker. Everything is mine. I live in a world which is so rich because I don't have to own it. I don't have to have it. It's just there. I can enjoy it. Therefore, it's mine. In the Sigalaka Sutta, he talks about having a helpful... The Buddha talks about having a helpful friend. They look after you when you are inattentive. They look after your possessions when you are inattentive. They are a refuge when you are afraid. And when some business is to be done, they let you have twice what you ask for. So it's interesting when Sigalaka is talking about generosity, he's sort of also, the Buddha's also indicating that there's often an edge to generosity. There's an edge where we say this far and no further. But what he's inviting us to do is to try and go beyond a reciprocal relationship. So very much a lot of kind of modern understanding of generosity and you know, capitalist society is about a reciprocal relationship. I'll give you this if you give me that. And then we go with a state of mind that's sort of utilitarian and sort of bargaining. So you've done this, therefore I'll do this. You've given me that, so therefore I'll give you that. Or I've given you that, therefore you should give me that. And it becomes a notion of who deserves dana. You know, who deserves dana? And we have a sense of entitlement. I deserve dana, you don't. Or even I don't deserve dana and you do. It's very painful because what we do to others, we do to ourselves. And if we live in this world, which is an apportioning generosity, apportioning who should have what, it can be very tight and fixed and you have this little tally going on. And Moga Bankshu and I always used to have this joke in Sheffield Buddhist Centre because I used to get quite annoyed if people would finish the margarine and leave the tub in the fridge. It's just one of those things. Anyway, so I used to have this joke where I'd go and find one of these margarine tubs and I'd say, if people would just throw away the margarine or recycle the margarine tub, you know, not put it back in the fridge. So we'd have this joke all the time where everything, you know, that went wrong in the Buddhist centre, he'd say, if people would just... Well, I found it quite helpful, actually, because it did get me out of that state of mind. It's blame, basically. So in friendship, we're trying to move away from the if people attitude to doing just what needs to be done and for watching out for each other, even when our friend has been inattentive or negligent. Obviously, if someone is habitually not doing anything and you need to have a little word with them, then fair enough. But actually, most of the time, that's not what's going on. What's going on is we've got an idea about who should do what. We're reluctant to help past a certain point. But my experience is also that if we all take responsibility for ourselves and also help each other, it all happens. There's a kind of flow that emerges. And that's definitely my experience of, for example, the setup before this retreat. It's not just saying, well, you should be doing that, you should be doing that, you should be doing that. We all have our jobs, you know, that we were apportioned at the beginning of the day. But if someone needs help, you just help. So sometimes we'd be doing a job and someone will come and say, actually, we need more people to lift up a dome or do something. And then this flow emerges. And what I noticed in myself is that the more that people help me out, the more I feel like I want to help others. And then it's just a job that needs to be done. We do what needs to be done rather than this kind of deserving or undeserving attitude. And this beautiful flow emerges. And what emerges also is an incredible sense of gratitude. There were times on that retreat, because I did feel a bit useless some of the time, you know, not quite competent. I'm not used to not feeling effective. I reported about that. It's not a comfortable feeling for me, feeling ineffective. Anyway, but what arose was just a lot of gratitude of people helping me in all sorts of situations. You know, like when I went to the toilet in the poo trench and discovered afterwards that there was no toilet paper. What does one do? I just called out. Is there anyone in the vans? And then Heidi appeared, like a goddess, the goddess of toilet roll. I think I've ever been so grateful to anyone in my life. So that's what we want to encourage in the Sangha, is that sense of generosity. What we don't want to encourage is reflecting the inequalities in society in our own Sangha. Because I think that's where that leads. That reciprocal relationship leads to storing and hoarding of wealth, and leads to an unequal... once you get an inequality in society, it perpetuates itself. And we don't want that. Banti was very keen on this. He liked talking about money, actually, in the order, saying we don't want to, just reflect the inequalities in society in our Sangha. And he gave a seminar on the duties of brotherhood in Islam, which is quite an interesting text, actually. And in the duties of brotherhood in Islam, it says that the lowest form of giving is from your surplus, as if they were your servant. But it's better to give equally. And the highest form of giving is to give to your friend more than you have yourself, and set their need before your own. And the ultimate failure is to oblige your friend to ask. So when we were talking about this, it was like, you know, I studied this, the seminar itself. I was thinking, gosh, you know, I think I'm still on the lowest form, which is giving from my surplus. If I don't need it, you can have it, basically. So, yes, how can I move that edge of giving of this far and no further, beyond and beyond and beyond, you know, and noticing where that edge is. It's an interesting practice, thinking, I've just reached the end of my dana. Is that because actually, you know, I do need, for example, to go and rest, or is there a reason for that that's helpful? Is it coming from a place of generosity in a broader sense, for example, also towards myself? Or is it coming actually just from a sense of mine, you know? So, yes. So that's why the Buddha says that you give twice what they ask for. You go beyond that edge of generosity. Because you love your friend, because they're precious to you, and because you want to help. Which means that we also have to receive generosity from friends with grace. You know, it's very hard sometimes for us to do that, to ask for help when we need help, and to accept help, and to accept generosity. Because I think we're conditioned to fear the reciprocal relationship so much that we think if someone helps us, we think we owe them something. But maybe we don't. You know, maybe they just want to give to us. You know, maybe we just have to take that. Yeah. I really had to learn that in India, actually, because people are very, very generous and they often want to give you food. And I'm really greedy and I really like Indian food. So I accept that well, but then it gets a bit too much. There's only one certain amount one person can eat. And then they find out that you really like something, which in my case is pretty much everything. And then they make it for you. Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. So also accepting generosity and just trusting in the process that dana invites dana, generosity invites dana, generosity. And also katanyata, gratitude. And gratitude arising because we value what we've been given and we know what we've been given. As I said before, one of the 10 reflections of the Buddha is my life depends on others. We're not independent being. We're completely dependent on every level for the generosity of others, for our very existence. And the Buddha also talks about being a refuge when your friend is afraid, which is the gift of fearlessness. So the Buddha said that the two greatest gifts are the gift of fearlessness and the gift of the Dharma. So it's also being the kind of person that when disaster strikes, your friend turns to you because you're solid in your practice and because you've cultivated skillful states of mind, basically. So your skillful states of mind are a refuge for others and they're a generous gift to others. Because when that person really needs you, you'll be there. And one thing I think it's interesting to reflect on is who will you turn to in the middle of the night if you need to go to hospital? You know, or even when you're ill and your bodily processes are such that someone else needs to clear them up, you know. And one shouldn't be afraid of asking for help in those times because it's a gift to give to someone, even in those times, you know. And I know that, you know, the Tirunelveli community in Karanadir really helped me when I just couldn't have helped myself. And I've had to do that. I've had to wake up Chandraprabha in the middle of the night and say, you know, I need you to take me to A&E. And she just doesn't, I realised afterwards I never even said thank you. Because I didn't need to say thank you, because it wasn't an issue. She just sat with me the whole night. Yeah. So, yes. So we can be that. That's one of the greatest gifts. The greatest gift is the gift of the Dharma. But also the gift of fearlessness. We can give that to our friends by being in positive mental states. Yeah. The near enemy of the rite of fascination is having an investment in being a helper. So I think we can all get into this in our various ways, the rescuer. We sort of need to be needed, and then we use dana, generosity, to sort of possess someone, which is again a living out of the reciprocal relationship. We're basically saying, I've done this for you, so now you owe me. And it can also manifest in a bit of a different way, which is an investment in being the educator. So I think you get this sometimes in the Sangha when you get people who are of different ages, or if you're an order member or not, you know, the order member to the Mitra, you can get an investment in being like the one who knows and who's going to tell people how it is. It's quite unattractive, actually, when I see it in myself. It's a kind of form of control, really, or playing the guru, or sort of smothering someone with your advice and help. It's like that joke about the scout, when the scoutmaster gets them all at the end of the week, and he says, have you done anything for anyone else? And this little boy says, yes, I helped an old woman to cross the road. And he said, oh, great. And he said, yeah, it was really difficult because she didn't want to cross the road. So it's that kind of thing when you're not really seeing the person. You just have an investment in being the helper or the educator. And I think that's why I'm really actually grateful to my father, because my father's a very cultured man and he's a great lover of the arts. And when I was little, he took me to art exhibitions and he said, you can like whatever you like. Don't think you have to like something or not like something. Just because something's by some great artist doesn't mean you like it. And we would do this thing where we'd go around the exhibition really quickly. And then he'd say, just go back to what you responded to. Whatever you responded to, just go back to that and sit with that for a while. I'm really grateful for that, actually, because it did give me a sense of, you know, I was very nervous. And I think when I was younger, maybe still now, I sort of wanted to impress my father and like the right things. And he said, I'm not watching, I don't know. You know, you just go and respond to what you respond to. The far enemy of the yellow rite is envy. And I think when people get into the state of envy, lack of mudita or jealousy, I often ask them, well, what's going on in your own creative life? Because I think we get into a state of envy of others' creative life when we're not leading the creative life we need to live in our own. So I think if that happens, if you feel like your spiritual life is drying up somewhat or your creative life is drying up, you need to stop. Just stop. And then notice what you respond to and follow the threads of your inspiration wherever they lead. You know, it happens to us all at different stages in our spiritual lives. And just stop. That's what I've had to do recently. Stop, stand back, see what kind of little any glimmers and follow them through. So yes, so the yellow right is about giving to each other and enriching each other's life. And both of you can give by your friendship. And when we give to each other in this way, we enrich each other's lives with spiritual friendship, we're also giving to the world. I think friendship can be the fourth sight, and it is for many of us. We came to the Dharma, and what really attracted us was the friendship between the Sangha members. I hear that again and again and again in people's spiritual journeys. There's something about teams working together. You know, for example, the Buddhafield team. So delightful. I mean, I'm quite happy just to stand on the sidelines and or just sit there and just watch everybody working. That sounds not very good, does it? Dana. But you know, there is something about just seeing people working together effectively and with kindness and happiness that's totally joyful for oneself to witness. It's a fourth sight. I have this with, there's a team a bit like the Buddhafield team in India. They're called The Team, and they do things like set up retreat for 4,000 people. And Kusala Devi knows, and Karen Adi knows them. And when I go to India, my best thing is just hanging out with them. And I can't even understand what they're saying, because most of the time they're talking in Marathi or Hindi. But they've sort of adopted me, which is really kind of them. And they have great fun. They work so hard. They set everything up. And then after the puja, they go back to the kitchen and cook another meal. So I'm not there. And they're talking away, whatever they're talking away about. But I just really enjoy being with them. And eating. Seems to be the theme of this. It's great. Oh, I just go to the convention and just watch the Indian team working together. They're such fantastic human beings. Banti calls it, compared this kind of offering of friendship, a garden in the wilderness. You know, there's so many difficulties in the world that we're facing at the moment. And I really do believe that the answer to it all is living as a community, and a joyful living as a community, and offering that community living to others. So I'm going to end by reading from Barbara Hepworth. Because also Barbara Hepworth was not only a sculptor, but she was also a social activist. And she linked the arts and social activism together. So I'm going to read you that. She says... And then she wrote this in 1960, after the Second World War. So, but a lot of it is very pertinent to now. She says, "I work to affirm, to do something positive, to underline what is affirmative. I want to emphasize in the affirmative all the elements of human beings which are vital and able to give praise for life. In my activity of trying to work, I attempt to eliminate all that is pessimistic and to communicate to others the optimism I feel inside myself. There is now the possibility of a total world brought together by the universal language of art. Because of the danger we all face, there is a heightened awareness of things that matter, of poetry, art and music. These are the things which will be instrumental in saving us. When the last war broke out, I was surprised by the way these things suddenly mattered so much more to people. That is why, at this threatening time, it is so vital to continue this kind of work. You have got to believe in the extraordinary beauty which is outside of yourself, because that is what will make you fight to preserve it. This is the time to change our way of thinking, which has become somewhat obsolete in the past few years. I am only a link in a chain, but at least I hope I am a solid link link, not a cracked one.
No.